that happens in life can happen in a show. You can make them laugh, you can make them cry. Anything, anything can go.
Welcome to your weekend. This is Weekend Showcase, your North State Arts Magazine. I'm Tom Kinney. The Walworth Farce, a most unusual Irish play, just opened at Chico's Blue Room Theater. It careens from madcap comic farce to domestic drama to dark, disturbing, and bloody contemporary realism. Today we talk with the director and with the lead actor from this play like no play you've ever seen. We'll also visit Chico State's Turner Print Museum to talk with the curator about the Turner's new exhibit, Deep Etch, showcasing works by the university's past masters of printmaking. That's coming up over the next half hour here on Weekend Showcase. Stay tuned. First, here's Brian Maul with the North State Arts Calendar.
In Reading tonight at the Cascade Theater, the group Five Sacks. Combining music with comic theater, this quintet mixes together American jazz, South American Latin styles, and European folk music. These masters of innovative brass begin their concert at 7:30. Tomorrow afternoon at Reading Civic Auditorium, Moscow Ballet's Great Russian Nutcracker. Spreading goodwill and Christmas spirit, this ballet begins at the family-friendly time of 3 o'clock. Tomorrow night in Reading, the Oak Song Society presents singer, songwriter, and guitarist Richard Schindel. His music paints pictures, inhabits characters, and tells stories. His concert at Reading's Pilgrim Congregational Church starts at 8 o'clock tomorrow. Wednesday at the Cascade, legendary singer, songwriter, and activist Joan Baez, promoting her new album, Whistle Down the Wind. This influential musical force begins her concert at 8 o'clock. At the Shasta College Art Gallery, selected works from the Cohen Collection. This art dealer's acquisitions from the 1970s feature contemporary European graphics, Spanish artwork, and limited edition books. The gallery, in Shasta's art department, is open Monday through Thursday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Friday, 9 a.m. to noon. The Orland Art Center's exhibit, A Handsome Harvest, showcases paintings by Marilyn Walsh and ceramics by Michelle Turner. The center's open Tuesday through Saturday, 1 to 6. There's a lot happening on the Esplanade in Chico at MONCA, the Museum of Northern California Art. In the MONCA Library, Tibetan-American scholar Losang Samten continues his creation, Mandala of the Lotus, using the ancient and sacred practice of sand painting. At MONCA tomorrow, the North State Symphony presents Behind the Curtain, a rehearsal in the gallery. Watch how conductor Scott Seaton and the symphony prepare for a concert. This peek into the creative process happens from 2 to 4 tomorrow. Closing on Sunday at MONCA, the exhibit Diverse Minds, a program to promote mental wellness in Northern California through the creation of art. MONCA's open Thursday through Sunday from 11 to 5. In Chico State's Humanities Building, the Jackie Headley University Art Gallery features Legal Gender, the irreverent art of Anita Steckel. Before she passed away in 2012, feminist artist Steckel worked primarily in collage and montage, but also produced paintings, sculptures, and photographs. The University Art Gallery is open Tuesday through Saturday, noon to 4. Tomorrow evening, in Chico State's Harlan Adams Theater, a concert titled Symphonic Winds, All Music Was Once New. The name was inspired by the public radio show Composer's Datebook. The music begins at 7:30. Sunday afternoon, at the Zing Recital Hall on the Chico State campus, the San Francisco Grand Opera Cinema Series presents Bellini's Norma. This bel canto masterpiece fills the big screen starting at 2 o'clock. Opening tonight in Paradise at Theater on the Ridge, the rock and roll musical High Noon on Wall Street, written and directed by Jerry Miller. Showtimes are 7:30 tonight and tomorrow night, and 2 o'clock on Sunday. On the Butte College main campus, in the Arts Building's Black Box Theater, only three more performances of Sideshow, the Broadway musical based on the true story of conjoined twins Daisy and Violet Hilton. Experience this spooky but emotionally affecting show tonight or tomorrow night at 7:30 or Sunday afternoon at 2. That's the calendar for this week. Born on today's date, movie star Burt Lancaster. "I always try to improve," remarked Lancaster, "to find new ways of expressing myself, to keep looking for truth and originality."
I'm here at the Blue Room Theater in Chico. Their new production is The Walworth Farce. We're going to be talking about it first with the director, Alex Hilsey. Alex, what did you think of this play when you first read it?
I was blown away by it. It's a wild ride. Just even reading it, you get this exhilarating adrenaline rush.
I don't think it's like any play I've ever seen before. It's a farce, but it's kind of a forced farce. They're recreating this script that was written by the father, who has a lot of axes to grind about the past. And then by the end of the play, it fades into a real-world, bloody, tragic thing. How did you blend these two strong but very different tones?
Well, I think you said it right there. They're two very strong and different tones. And the trick to that is really just committing fully in the performance to both the farce and the darker tones that take place in reality.
What kind of play is that? Farce.
Farce is an exaggerated, over-the-top, almost caricature of life and its extremities.
So it's got a very wild, broad style that exaggerates reactions and everything. So, Alex, I got to ask you this. What was it like directing, I think it's your first real full-length play, and the play is starring your own father, Joe Hilsey, overall artistic director of the Blue Room Theater. And it's a play about a father who obsessively rehearses his children. He just clings on to this story. What was that like for you to direct your father being an obsessive director?
Oh my gosh. Well, my dad and I, we had from the beginning a really wonderful working relationship. I mean, this is my first play. I'm still learning. I'm a very young director. And first of all, it's just surreal having grown up in the Blue Room from like the age of 5, you know, and now I'm here doing what I've always wanted to do, which is tell a story to the community that I was brought up in. And my father was the person who brought me into this community. In the beginning, he was supposed to co-direct this with me, and we had another actor on the bill. But then he had to take over the role, and I became the director. And he said, "I'm just going to act as a guiding eye for you." And he was absolutely that.
Well, the character Joe Hilsey, your father, is playing, he has this line where he says, "Story is everything." What's the line?
For what are we, Maureen, if we're not our stories?
Is the telling of stories through theater central to you and your family?
Every single one of us in our family, my sister, my father, I was brought up with story and a culture of story and with only the most brilliant of people. I'm just very grateful to finally take a seat here, you know? It's funny because in the play, what Dennis has created is...
Dennis is the part that your father's playing.
Yes. And what he's created for his sons is this trade of farce and storytelling, but for no audience. On the outside, it's my father, my stepmother, who've created for my sister and I a family trade that they never foisted upon us. This was our babysitting, basically, just you know, having to come to the theater. But we ended up taking to it because how do you not when it's so magical?
Well, I'd have to say this is an oddball play. How would you sum up the experience that audiences will have if they go see the Walworth farce at the Blue Room Theater?
There's a tradition of this in Ireland, the idea of storytelling being a defensive device and a mechanism used in self-preservation and preserving the truth or your truth, your family's story.
And Dennis is so obsessive about every little detail of this farce that he keeps having his sons put on with him over and over and over.
He is, and he has a script for the show that he is consistently updating. Whenever he comes up with a new idea or a new line or someone suggests something, he'll write it down in the script, and it's constantly updated, constantly edited. And Sean, one of the sons, he's not very good at the farce. You know, it's not what he longs to do. He's forced to do it every day. And so he gets the brunt of Dinny's malevolence and violence, I think, when it comes to adhering to the details.
What we've been describing, obsessively acted and then acted again, and it seems like they've been doing this forever, that's what takes up the whole first act of the play in this two-act play. In the second act, there's a new character that comes in from the outside world.
Haley, coming in at the end of Act One, she is very much an advocate and a herald on the audience's behalf. She finds it very funny, very amusing, until she realizes that they can't break out of it. It isn't until she tries to leave that everything changes.
She seems to be trapped there. But if I went to this apartment and found out this family was freaking bonkers... and probably dangerous, I would get out of there no matter what. What did you give her for motivation to keep her there?
She is afraid for her life. She has been placed in a place of peril and panic that is inescapable. The only way she really has of escaping is one portal, which is the front door that is kept guarded at all times, and her phone, which as you'll see in the play, is soon no longer an option.
Well, now we have the lead actor of the Walworth farce. This is Joe Hilsey, who also happens to be the grand leader of the Blue Room in general. So what's it like being directed by your daughter in her directorial debut?
Well, it's a fantastic experience, actually. Originally, we were supposed to co-direct the play. We had an incident where the actor playing the part of the father, Denny, and he couldn't do it. So as often happens in theater, it's like, well, what are we going to do? I said, well, I will assume the role. And then Alex took over as sole director. And so it was great because we could still collaborate. We had a postmortem every evening after every rehearsal. And so it was a fantastic experience.
Well, when you were putting together this season for The Blue Room, this was one of the plays that you chose to do. I have to say it's a very oddball play.
It's like nothing I have ever seen before, ever. 7 or 8 years ago, we did a reading of it, and we're toying with the idea of maybe doing it, but the casting didn't quite work out. That play has sort of been gnawing at me since then. It's like, well, one day we'll do Walworth Farce, and every season we put it together, it's like, well, it didn't quite fit that play in it, but one day I want to do Walworth Farce. It just came to a point. Alex had just come back from Ireland. She spent the summer in Ireland last year. She, of course, you know, grew up with my love of Irish theater, and she has her own love of Irish theater as well. And I had introduced her to this play, and it's well known in Ireland. And she said, oh, well, we should do that if we can. And so we decided to do it.
I know you yourself have done a lot of acting. I'm wondering, have you been in an out-and-out farce before?
No, not really. I mean, I've done some plays that have had some farcical elements. In college, I did some Commedia dell'arte stuff like that, and, you know, a little bit of restoration comedy, which can touch on farce as well. But not just an out-and-out, run around and switch costumes and do all this kind of thing and mistaken identities. You know, truth be told, I'm not the hugest fan of farce. But what I like about this is it sort of deconstructs farce. It's not a true farce, you know. It's people that have never seen a farce trying to do a farce. And I love the whole play within a play. As a matter of fact, there was a really interesting article I had read recently, Enda Walsh talking about one of the reasons he wrote this play is because there is no farce in Irish theater. And so he said, well, I want to do one because there are no Irish farces. It was something that was purely English and French and American.
So your character, Denny, is very Irish, proud of being Irish. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like the English much. How did your character get so immersed and obsessive about putting on a farce?
Well, that's a good question. It's never really explored why they chose this genre. It's like you have to act it as if it's somebody who's never seen a play before. Denny, who's written this play, constructed it for his children. They act it out every day, but you get the sense they don't know much about theater. And so it's not like, oh, we're being real cute by being real bad. It's not that, because they're so earnest in what they do. This play that they perform is everything to them. You know, to Denny, this is what defines them, that they perform this play every day in their little broken down apartment. Every day they perform this play, and it is their entire life, and it revolves around that. They do it with 100% of themselves. And I think the farce lends itself to that because it's so big and it's so over the top. And so it can really contain just the overblown emotions of Denny and his, you know, strange children.
It's fun to see you as Denny rehearsing the bits. You rehearse those big physical reactions. Describe the style of farce that Denny is so obsessive about getting into.
Actually, Denny's idea of farce isn't far from mine. You know, really well-done farce, it has to have all the true emotion that you would have in realistic theater, but you just explode it and it's much larger. We did a lot of that in rehearsal. It's like, let's just do this as a regular play, as a realistic play, and you take it a step farther, and you take it a step farther, and you take it a step farther, and you make it big, and you find each little moment. If it's a physical moment, oh, there's a physical moment. You were startled a little bit. You had a little startle. Well, now let's find that same impulse and make it a huge jump. But it comes from someplace that's real. And I think when it's really clicking and when it's really working well, you have that same communication, that same connection with the other actors doing this farce that you would in doing a realistic play. And one of the reasons why I love this play is because it does break down. They do the farce, and when the farce breaks down and it goes into the realistic, half of the play is just the realism of them living in this apartment, you know, and then of them dealing with the fact that they got to get back to doing this play. And then the other half is them telling the story through this farce, and we get the story of how they ended up to be here and how they started to do this whole ritual of doing this play every day. So it's a story told in different genres. We're going along in farce and it just stops and it becomes something else. And then we go into realism. It's like, well, hey, let's try this other thing instead. And for me, it's just wonderful to just drop into some other acting style entirely.
Describe what it's like for you playing this broad, big farce kind of style, and then to edge at the end of the play into what feels to me like actual bloody tragedy.
And that's what it is. And it becomes a tragedy at the end. And so we have this farce. We have this sort of realistic domestic drama, kitchen sink drama in there as well. And at the end, it's a tragedy about the destruction of this once very tight-knit family. You know, everything gets torn apart. Everything they've been living for and living with each other for years and years, this is the day that it all ends. And so it's wonderful. And again, this is one of the reasons why I'm so drawn to this play, because it's not what it appears to be. And then when you think it's something else, then it becomes something else, and you're never quite sure. It's not till the end where you can sort of piece everything together and say, wow, this was really so many different things happening on so many different levels. And it's just very rich, very Irish in that respect. And also in Irish in the respect that they talk over and over again about how we are defined by our stories. What are we if we're not our stories? That's sort of the closing line of the farce. What are we, Maureen, if we are not our stories? And her reply is, we're the lost and the lonely. And that just sort of sums up everything is to them, and particularly Denny the father. It's like, this is the story of us. This is the story of me. We find out later he's embellishing quite a bit to the point where it's like it's all a lie. And at the end, we don't know what was the truth and what was not the truth as far as this story Denny is creating.
We've been talking with Joe Hilsey, who is the central character, the father Denny, in The Walworth Farce. It's now on stage at the Blue Room Theater in Chico.
This is Dolores Mitchell. Today I'm inside the Janet Turner Print Museum on the CSUC campus, speaking with Catherine Sullivan, curator of the collection. We're going to talk today about Deep Etch, Legends of Chico Printmaking, an exhibition now at the Turner through the end of the semester. How did this exhibition come about?
One of the things I was thinking about was the sheer numbers of artists represented in the collection who had some form of teaching role here at the university, and putting together an exhibition that represents printmaking on this campus since the 1940s, itself a kind of history lesson in not only the changing role of arts on the campus, but also how the different art movements are reflected within the artistic output of the individual faculty member.
I'm amazed how much color there is for a print exhibition.
It is a rather colorful exhibition. A lot of times we think printmaking is a little monochromatic. Some of the techniques are difficult to create using color, but some of them, certainly the abstract expressionist pieces by Ken Morrow and Winston McGordon, because they're screen printed, that's certainly a process that lends itself to additional color. Also, there are a few monoprints, which is another way to get color in prints that is not quite as laborious as creating a separate block or plate for each color.
Some of the artists in this exhibition are not known as printmakers.
There is a certain seduction in the process of printmaking that I think is sometimes appealing in that it's not as direct as drawing or painting is. Janet maybe twisted people's arms and saying, oh, you should try printmaking. You're a graphic artist too. A lot of the artists that are represented are graphic artists to begin with. They are familiar with those kinds of tools, like pencils, crayons, and drawing or painting.
I was looking when I came into the gallery for works by Janet Turner. I was completely surprised when I came upon some very abstract works by Janet.
We think of her primarily as a representational artist, but she's had some very complete showings of different parts of her career. With this, I thought of looking for those things that I know I had not shown. I chose some things where I think the idea of abstraction is a little bit more in the forefront of what she's doing, although she's working at that via a device like a cow skull or a landscape that has a more familiar meaning to the average viewer.
Well, what she's really known for in this area are her birds, which are so precise in their details and involve so much study of photographs, of claws, of feathers, of bits of the habitat. So it really was quite astonishing to see these abstract works.
One of the things that you see throughout her work is going to be that attention to detail. She's interested in texture, pattern. She's interested in how those overlap and compete with each other within a picture plane. It's just the things I chose for this are a little more photographic in the aspect that you can use the camera lens to cut things off, to foreshorten. There's a different level of pictorial language, I think, that she's speaking with these that I thought people might not be familiar with her having done.
I was also amazed by the variety of techniques here. So anyone interested in printmaking will see mezzotint, we'll see etchings, we'll see sugar lift images. What else would people be surprised perhaps to see here?
The theme to this exhibition is the variety. Janet, as a printmaker, really was proficient in all the different techniques. And so fundamental to the department has always been this ability to find an expressive means one way or another. When you look at the history of all the people here that have come through the doors and taught and brought their own aesthetic with them, they sort of reinforce the fact that printmaking has a variety of ways of getting its message across.
How has this space been for you to work with as the curator?
Well, it's the largest display space that the Turner has ever had. And so it obviously takes a little more time and work to change out exhibitions.
Can you give listeners some sense of the Janet Turner Print Museum holdings?
Currently, we have 4,011 prints that are cataloged, meaning that those are ones that have their records up to date and are in circulation, which is almost double the original gift of close to 2,000 prints that Janet made in the 80s to start the museum with. Over time, what that means is our numbers have increased and our diversity has increased, and we continue to collect works primarily global in nature, and that reflect the diversity of printmaking. Printmaking as an art form has a history and has a future.
Deep Etch, Legends of Chico Printmaking on the CSUC campus. There may be some listeners who have not been to the Turner Gallery in its new location.
The Turner Print Museum, in one form or another, has been on the campus since the 1980s. So we have a long history, but a new location. This new building encompasses the arts adjacent to us. We have the MFA Gallery and the Jackie Headley University Art Gallery. And we're in the location of Taylor Hall, that was the building that preceded us. We're easily recognized because the same mural was recreated for the end of the building at the roundabout where Salem meets First Street. And it's just a short stroll down the plaza to our glassed-in lobby, and that's our entrance. You can reach us through.
I hope you'll have a marvelous audience for the rest of this show. When is the closing date, and what are the hours of the collection?
The gallery is open Tuesday through Saturday, noon to 4. We are closed on Monday. However, we can be open for groups and tours by special arrangements by calling the office 898-4476 or emailing us here at the museum. We go through the end of the semester, so we go through December 8th. We will be closed the week of Thanksgiving, however.
Well, thank you so much.
And that's Weekend Showcase for this week. We'll be back next Friday at 3 o'clock. If you ever miss this program at its regular broadcast time, you can hear it online anytime after 3:30 Friday at mynspr.org. As always, we encourage you to enjoy the arts in the North State. For Weekend Showcase, I'm Tom Kinney. Weekend Showcase is a production of North State Public Radio.